So did you guys work out an order for reading already, or?
I see Andrea, me, you, Geoffrey, and then John Robert.
Okay.
And do we need to do a little announcement about what we're reading today? Just to.
Yeah, I would say so. So it is also recorded. We are on at chapter 7, Standards of Conduct and Spiritual Freedom, paragraph 8, which in the new edition I think is page 192, the third section.
There are four main standards of human conduct that make it an ascending scale. The first is personal need, preference, and desire. The second is the law and good of the collectivity. The third is an ideal ethic. The last is the highest divine law of the nature. Man starts on the long career of his evolution with only the first two of these four to enlighten and lead him, for they constitute the law of his animal and vital existence, and it is as the vital and physical animal man that he begins his progress. The true business of man upon earth is to express in the type of humanity a growing image of the divine. Whether knowingly or unknowingly, it is to this end that nature is working in him under the thick veil of her inner and outer processes. But the material or animal man is ignorant of the inner aim of life. He knows only its needs and its desires, and he has necessarily no other guide to what is required of him than his own perception of need and his own stirrings and pointings of desire. To satisfy his physical and vital demands and necessities before all things else, and in the next rank, whatever emotional or mental cravings or imaginations or dynamic notions rise in him, must be the first natural rule of his conduct. The sole balancing or overpowering law that can modify or contradict this pressing natural claim is a demand put on him by the ideas, needs, and desires of his family, community, or tribe, the herd, the pack of which he is a member.
If man could live to himself, and this he could only do if the development of the individual were the sole object of the divine in the world, this second law would not at all need to come into operation. But all existence proceeds by the mutual action and reaction of the whole and the parts, the need for each other of the constituents and the thing constituted, the interdependence of the group and the individuals of the group. In the language of Indian philosophy, the divine manifests himself always in the double form of the separative and the collective being, Vyashti Samashti. Man, pressing after the growth of his separate individuality and its fullness and freedom, is unable to satisfy even his own personal needs and desires, except in conjunction with other men. He is a whole in himself and yet incomplete without others. This obligation englobes his personal law of conduct in a group law, which arises from the formation of a lasting group entity with a collective mind and life of its own, to which his own embodied mind and life are subordinated as a transitory unit. And yet, is there something in him immortal and free, not bound to this group body, which outlasts his own embodied existence, but cannot outlast or claim to chain by its law his eternal spirit?
in itself, this seemingly larger and overriding law, is no more than extension of the vital and animal principle that governs the individual elementary man. It is the law of the pack or herd. The individual identifies partially his life with the life of a certain number of other individuals with whom he is associated by birth, choice, or circumstance. And since the existence of the group is necessary for his own existence and satisfaction, in time, if not from the first, its preservation, the fulfillment of its needs, and the satisfaction of its collective notions, desires, habits of living, without which it would not hold together, must come to take a primary place. The satisfaction of personal idea and feeling, need and desire, propensity and habit, has to be constantly subordinated by the necessity of the situation, and not from any moral or altruistic motive, to the satisfaction of the ideas and feelings, needs and desires, propensities and habits, not of this or that other individual or number of individuals, but of the society as a whole. This social need is the obscure matrix of morality and of man's ethical impulse.
It is not actually known that in any primitive times man lived to himself or with only his mate, as do some of the animals. All record of him shows him to us as a social animal, not an isolated body and spirit. The law of the pack has always overridden his individual law of self-development. He seems always to have been born, to have lived, to have been formed as a unit in a mass. But logically and naturally, from the psychological viewpoint, the law of personal need and desire is primary. Excuse me. The social law comes in as a secondary and usurping power. Man has in him two distinct master impulses, the individualistic and the communal, a personal life and a social life, a personal motive of conduct and a social motive of conduct. The possibility of their opposition and the attempt to find their equation lie at the very roots of human civilization and persist in other figures when he has passed beyond the vital animal into a highly individualized mental and spiritual progress.
The existence of a social law external to the individual is at different times a considerable advantage and a disadvantage to the development of the divine in man. It is an advantage at first when man is crude and incapable of self-control and self-finding, because it erects a power other than that of his personal egoism, through which that egoism may be induced or compelled to moderate its savage demands, to discipline its irrational and often violent movements, and even to lose itself sometimes in a larger and less personal egoism. It is a disadvantage to the adult spirit ready to transcend the human formula, because it is an external standard which seeks to impose itself on him from outside, and the condition of his perfection is that he shall grow from within and in an increasing freedom, not by the suppression, but by the transcendence of his perfected individuality. Not any longer by a law imposed on him that trains and disciplines his members, but by the soul from within, breaking through all previous forms to possess with its light and transmute his members.
In the conflict of the claims of society with the claims of the individual, two ideal and absolute solutions confront one another. There is a demand of the group that the individual should subordinate himself more or less completely, or even lose his independent existence in the community. The smaller must be immolated or self-offered to the larger unit. He must accept the need of the society as his own need, the desire of society as his own desire. He must live not for himself, but for the tribe, clan, commune, or nation of which he is a member. The ideal and absolute solution from the individual standpoint would be a society that existed not for itself, for its all overriding collective purpose, but for the good of the individual and his fulfillment, for the greater and more perfect life of all its members. Representing as far as possible his best self and helping him to realize it, it would respect the freedom of each of its members and maintain itself not by law and force, but by the free and spontaneous consent of its constituent persons. An ideal society of either kind does not exist anywhere and would be most difficult to create, more difficult still to keep an in precarious existence so long as an individual man clings to his egoism as a primary motive of existence. A general but not complete domination of society over the individual is the easier way, and it is the system that nature from the first instinctively adopts and keeps in equilibrium by rigorous law, compelling custom and careful indoctrination of the still subservient and ill-developed intelligence of the human creature.
In primitive societies, the individual life is submitted to rigid and immobile communal custom and rule. This is the ancient and would-be eternal law of the human pack that tries always to masquerade as the everlasting decree of the imperishable, Esa Dharma Sanatana. And the ideal is not dead in the human mind. The most recent trend of human progress is to establish an enlarged and sumptuous edition of this ancient turn of collective living toward the enslavement of the human spirit. There is here a serious danger to the integral development of a greater truth upon earth and a greater life. For the desires and free seekings of the individual, however egoistic, however false or perverted they may be in their immediate form, contain in their obscure shell the seed of a development necessary to the whole. His searchings and stumblings have behind them a force that has to be kept and transmuted into the image of the divine ideal. That force needs to be enlightened and trained, but must not be suppressed or harnessed exclusively to society's heavy cartwheels. Individualism is as necessary to the final perfection as the power behind the group spirit. The stifling of the individual may well be the stifling of the God in man. And in the present balance of humanity, there is seldom any real danger of exaggerated individualism breaking up the social integer. There is continually a danger that the exaggerated pressure of the social mass, by its heavy, unlightened mechanical weight, may suppress or unduly discourage the free development of the individual spirit. For man in the individual can be more easily enlightened, conscious, open to clear influences. Man in the mass is still obscure, half conscious, ruled by universal forces that escape its mastery and its knowledge.
Against this danger of suppression and immobilization, nature in the individual reacts. It may react by an isolated resistance ranging from the instinctive and brutal revolt of the criminal to the complete negation of the solitary and ascetic. It may react by the assertion of an individualistic trend in the social idea, may impose it on the mass consciousness and establish a compromise between the individual and the social demand. But a compromise is not a solution. It only salves over the difficulty, and in the end, increases the complexity of the problem and multiplies its issues. A new principle has to be called in. A new principle has to be called in other and higher than the two conflicting instincts, and powerful at once to override and to reconcile them. Above the natural individual law, which sets up as our one standard of conduct the satisfaction of our individual needs, preferences, and desires, and the natural communal law, which sets up as a superior standard the satisfaction of the needs, preferences, and desires of the community as a whole, there had to arise the notion of an ideal moral law, which is not the satisfaction of need and desire, but controls and even coerces or annuls them in the interests of an ideal order that is not animal, not vital and physical, but mental, a creation of the minds seeking for light and knowledge and right rule and right movement and true order. The moment this notion becomes powerful in man, he begins to escape from the engrossing vital and material into the mental life. He climbs from the first to the second degree of the threefold ascent of nature. His needs and desires themselves are touched with a more elevated light of purpose, and the mental need, the ascetic, intellectual, and emotional desire begin to predominate over the demand of the physical and vital nature.
Does anybody like a little pause?
I think it's a good idea.
Yeah. Anybody comment, question? I have, but I'm glad to let everyone else go ahead.
I think this is fairly straightforward. I still have trouble with this idea of things moving to better, higher. I'm a stickler on this one, but the more I understand the world, the less I like this idea. So I may have to be a dissenter for Sri Aurobindo on this issue.
What does he say, higher or better?
Well, this idea that more elevated light and purpose, more, you know, this sort of climb idea, it's not my understanding of the world at all. I think it's a diversification and an emergence of different forms, but I don't necessarily agree that it's this continual movement there, one towards one state.
Progress.
Whatever you call it, yeah.
How I understand it, yes. He has this idea of higher and lower and the ladder from the bottom to the top. But what he, per definition, seems to me for him is higher is a divine. If one does not regard this as something better or less high or low, I don't know. But there is a distance between a divine state of being and a non-divine state of being. And the non-divine is considered the lowest.
Yeah.
And the divine is the highest.
I think my issue is if I don't buy into this progressive movement towards one direction, then what of the rest of Aurobindo's thought am I also not buying into? I mean, how much of his ideas are a single whole? And if you reject a chunk of it, you reject the whole thing. Or is it separate strands that, you know, so, I mean, I enjoy Aurobindo's thoughts and ideas and a lot of these things, but I'm not at all convinced of the sort of broader intellectual argument that is laid out here. Anyway, it's maybe
if something is painful and something is blissful, would you not, I mean, these are words, of course, but would you not agree that we can label the painful the lower state and the blissful the higher state?
But pain is good. Pain has its value. So
yeah, sure.
Why is one necessarily better than the other, you know?
Yeah, but why do we avoid that it then?
We don't.
Oh, I wonder if it helps.
I don't like pain.
I wonder if it helps to see it as being aware of the divine. Because everything is divine. So in the divine, there's no higher or lower.
Exactly.
But there isn't, in me, I know there's an evolution of becoming more and more aware of that.
Exactly.
And there I come out of my individual little self, you know, in this kind of progression that he talks about. And maybe that can circumvent the problem with the higher and lower. I don't know. My attempt.
Yeah, because obviously I don't reject it all. You know, I mean, I wouldn't be sitting here during this reading if I rejected it all.
Yeah.
But I have issues with parts of the way the argument is framed.
In fact, it's a good point, Andrea, that you say everything is the divine, and therefore, in principle, there is nothing higher and lower. And that's what also Sri Aurobindo says. Here and there, you will find, especially when he sees the things, I think, from the supramental point of view, he says that there, everything, also Mother used to say, everything is perfect. Yeah, yeah, but it depends from what level we see these things, of course. He is writing to us here, and he was writing to the people who were living in the ashram, I think, also, or other yogis. And most of them on us are still at the mental level. So that's how we can understand things. But yes, in a certain sense, it's all a matter of points of view. From the supramental point of view, everything is divine. Also the Asura, the demon, also Hitler, also everyone, everything. Yeah. But from other points of view, from other levels, you cannot use, I think, this categorization. But anyway, yeah, but I also agree with you, Jeffrey, that one must not accept everything. There are also some things in Sri Aurobindo where I say, I have some doubts. I'm not completely convinced, but I take that, what I find very inspirational and helps me to evolve. And it is also true what you said in there that yeah, when I look back to my life, yeah, I was 30, 40 years ago, and yeah, not that I'm much more evolved now, but but a little bit. I would, yeah, the words better, comes to my lips, yeah, instinctively. Not me as person, but there are things that I understand better, that I know better, that can do better. And this is obviously not a moral evaluation of myself, that now I am a better person. From certain standpoints of view, I'm even worse because I once was not able to react harshly. I was a very timid boy. Nowadays, I have learned to be also quite, and not always in the right way. But yes, there has been an evolution. One can see this also in one's own lifetime. At least I see this. So, but anyway, yeah, it's a long thing. Yeah. Some other considerations?
One of the images that some people use to kind of bring these two points together is the spiral. Hmm. So here's a straight line. Here's a spiral. And the spiral is, I mean, you could say the spiral goes from the light to the dark, from the light to the dark, from the light to the dark.
Spiral or a circle?
The spiral. Okay. So the spiral is going like this, but it's also spreading stuff all over the place. You know, it's not certainly not in a straight line.
Hmm. Yeah, but the spiral therefore implies that there is an evolution. The word evolution already betrays that there's X coming something out of, no? It is not just a circle that, well, it's the addition of itself in one form or another. It's not just a change of forms, like Darwinian evolution would imply. But there is a spiral, which means it goes out wider and wider. Yeah. But I didn't read that in this. It's interesting, if I may shortly share what I read, what left in me a deep impression of these few paragraphs, is that in fact he describes the situation in which our society is nowadays. Well, it was perhaps always, but nowadays especially, this necessity to put into equilibrium the necessities of the individual and of the collective. That we have to find, he says, the compromise is not sufficient. We have to find something better, where we can find the balance between the needs of the liberation of the spirit, of the individual spirit, and yet that it does not get into contrast with the collective development. What he's writing here, I think, is especially about this point. And that's what we are in a situation actually that we didn't find that equilibrium. There's always a disequilibrium, or the individual egoistic impulses are emphasized, or the necessity of the regime, of the dictatorship of the collective. The capitalistic system is more that individualistic tendency. Huh? But it wasn't a solution as well. So for me, he describes a very, very actual problem with which we have to deal still today, and we didn't find a solution at the social level, at the political level, in the educational system especially. That's what I read.
Thanks, Marco. I also felt some clarification happening in my reading of the world today. You know, reading these passages from Sri Aurobindo. Yeah.
Shall we continue?
Yep. Okay.
Okay. I think it was my turn.
Yep.
Okay. The natural law of conduct proceeds from a conflict to an equilibrium of forces, impulsions, and desires. The higher ethical law proceeds by the development of the mental and moral nature towards a fixed internal standard, or else a self-formed ideal of absolute qualities: justice, righteousness, love, right reason, right power, beauty, light. It is therefore essentially an individual standard. It is not a creation of the mass mind. The thinker is the individual. It is he who calls out and throws into forms that which would otherwise remain subconscious in the amorphous human whole. The moral striver is also the individual. Self-discipline, not under the yoke of an outer law, but in obedience to an internal light, is essentially an individual effort. But by positing his personal standard as the translation of an absolute moral ideal, the thinker imposes it not on himself alone, but on all the individuals whom his thought can reach and penetrate. And as the mass of individuals come more and more to accept it in idea, if only in an imperfect practice or no practice, society also is compelled to obey the new orientation. It absorbs the ideative influence and tries, not with any striking success, to mold its institutions into new forms touched by these higher ideals. But always its instinct is to translate them into binding law, into pattern forms, into mechanic custom, into an external social compulsion upon its living units.
For long after the individual has become partially free, a moral organism capable of conscious growth, aware of an inward life, eager for spiritual progress, society continues to be external in its methods, a material and economic organism, mechanical, more intent upon status and self-preservation than on growth and self-perfection. The greatest present triumph of the thinker and progressive individual over the instinctive and static society has been the power he has acquired by his thought will to compel it to think also, to open itself to the idea of social justice and righteousness, communal sympathy, and mutual compassion, to feel after the rule of reason rather than blind custom as a test of its institutions, and to look on the mental and moral ascent of its individuals as at least one essential element in the validity of its laws. Ideally, at least, to consider light rather than force as its sanction, moral development and not vengeance or restraint as the object even of its penal action, is becoming just possible to the communal mind. The greatest future triumph of the thinker will come when he can persuade the individual integer and the collective whole to rest their life relation and its union in stability upon a free and harmonious consent and self-adaptation, and shape and govern the external by the internal truth, rather than to constrain the inner spirit by the tyranny of the external form and structure.
But even this success that he has gained is rather a thing in potentiality than in actual accomplishment. There is always a disharmony and a discord between the moral law in the individual and the law of his needs and desires, between the moral law proposed to society and the physical and vital needs, desires, customs, prejudices, interests and passions of the caste, the clan, the religious community, the society, the nation. The moralist erects in vain his absolute ethical standard and calls upon all to be faithful to it without regard to consequences. To him, the needs and desires of the individual are invalid if they are in conflict with the moral law, and the social law has no claims upon him if it is opposed to his sense of right and denied by his conscience. This is his absolute solution for the individual, that he shall cherish no desires and claims that are not consistent with love, truth, and justice. He demands from the community or nation that it shall hold all things cheap, even its safety and its most pressing interests, in comparison with truth, justice, humanity, and the highest goods of the people. Highest good of the people.
No individual rises to these heights except in intense moments.
Oh, excuse me. I was having a question and I didn't realize I hadn't turned on my sound. So I'm a little confused with his line. He demands from the community or nation that it shall hold all things cheap, even its safety and its most pressing interests, in comparison with truth, justice, humanity, and the highest good of the peoples.
He's preparing to knock this down. It's one of these things where he's preparing an argument against this. So he's saying, he's speaking against those who fix only on the moral law and not on the other components, right?
Ah.
I think is where I think he's going.
Yeah, well, we'll continue and see if it gets clear.
I'm pretty sure it because he does that. He sets up these straw men and then he knocks them down, right? So
Yeah.
I think he's just describing what he sees. I mean, there certainly are moralists who do what he says and who live that way. No individual rises to these heights except in intense moments. No society yet created satisfies this ideal. And in the present state of morality and of human development, none perhaps can or ought to satisfy it. Nature will not allow it. Nature knows that it should not be. The first reason is that our moral ideals are themselves, for the most part, ill-evolved, ignorant, and arbitrary. Mental constructions rather than transcriptions of the eternal truths of the spirit. Authoritative and dogmatic, they assert certain absolute standards in theory, but in practice, every existing system of ethics proves either in application unworkable or is in fact a constant coming short of the absolute standard to which the ideal pretends. If our ethical system is a compromise or a makeshift, it gives at once a principle of justification to the further sterilizing compromises which society and the individual hasten to make with it. And if it insists on absolute love, justice, right, with an uncompromising insistence, it soars above the head of human possibility and is professed with lip homage, but ignored in practice. It is even found that it ignores other elements in humanity which equally insist on survival, but refuse to come within the moral formula. For just as the individual law of desire contains within it invaluable elements of the infinite whole, which have to be protected against the tyranny of the absorbing social idea, the innate impulses too, both of individual and of collective man, contain in them invaluable elements which escape the limits of any ethical formula yet discovered and are yet necessary to the fullness and harmony of an eventual divine perfection. Andrea, you're muted.
If you don't mind, I would like to read that last sentence again. Even if it is found that it ignores other elements in humanity which equally insist on survival, but refuse to come within the moral formula. For just as the individual law of desire contains within it invaluable elements of the infinite whole, which have to be protected against the tyranny of the absorbing social idea, the innate impulses too, both of individual and of collective man, contain in them invaluable elements, which is the limits of any ethical formula yet discovered, and are yet necessary to the fullness and harmony of an eventual divine perfection. Moreover, absolute love, absolute justice, absolute right reason in their present application by a bewildered and imperfect humanity come easily to be conflicting principles. Justice often demands what love abhors. Right reason, dispassionately considering the facts of nature and human relations in search of a satisfying norm or rule, is unable to admit without modification either any reign of absolute justice or any reign of absolute love. And in fact, man's absolute justice easily turns out to be, in practice, a sovereign injustice. For his mind, one-sided and rigid in its constructions, puts forward a one-sided, partial, and rigorous scheme or figure and claims for it totality and absoluteness and an application that ignores the subtler truth of things and the plasticity of life. All our standards turned into action either waver on a flux of compromises or err by this partially and unelastic structure. Humanity sways from one orientation to another. The race moves upon a zigzag path led by conflicting claims and on the whole works out instinctively what nature intends, but with much waste and suffering rather than either what it desires or what it holds to be right or what the highest light from above demands from the embodied spirit.
The fact is that when we have reached the cult of absolute ethical qualities and erected the categorical imperative of an ideal law, we have not come to the end of our search or touched the truth that delivers. There is, no doubt, something here that helps us to rise beyond limitation by the physical and vital man in us. An insistence that overpasses the individual and collective needs and desires of a humanity still bound to the living mud of matter in which it took its roots, an aspiration that helps to develop the mental and moral being in us. This new sublimating element has been therefore an acquisition of greater importance. Its workings have marked a considerable step forward in the difficult evolution of terrestrial nature. And behind the inadequacy of these ethical conceptions, something too is concealed that does attach to a supreme truth. There is here the glimmer of a light and power that are part of a yet unreached divine nature. But the mental idea of these things is not that light, and the moral formulation of them is not that power. These are only representative constructions of the mind that cannot embody the divine spirit, which they vainly endeavor to imprison in the categorical formulas. Beyond the mental and moral being in us is a greater divine being that is spiritual and supramental. For it is only through a large spiritual plane where the mind's formulas dissolve in a white flame of direct inner experience that we can reach beyond mind and pass from its constructions to the vastness and freedom of the supramental realities. There alone can we touch the harmony of the divine powers that are purely misrepresented to our mind or framed into a false figure by the conflicting or wavering elements of the moral law. There alone, the unification of the transformed vital and physical and the illumined mental man becomes possible in that supramental spirit, which is at once the secret source and goal of our mind and life and body. There alone is there any possibility of an absolute justice, love, and right, far other than that which we imagine, at one with each other in the light of a supreme divine knowledge. There alone can there be a reconciliation of the conflict between our members.
So there's a cautionary tale here. In other words, there is, above society's external law and man's moral law, and beyond them, though feebly and ignorantly aimed at by something within them, a larger truth of a vast, unbound consciousness. A law divine, towards which both these blind and gross formulations are progressive, faltering steps that try to escape from the natural law of the animal to a more exalted light or universal rule. That divine standard, since the Godhead in us is our spirit moving towards its own concealed perfection, must be a supreme spiritual law and truth of our nature. Again, as we are embodied beings in the world with a common existence and nature, and yet individual souls capable of direct touch with the transcendent, this supreme truth of ourselves must have a double character. It must be a law and truth that discovers the perfect movement, harmony, rhythm of a great spiritualized collective life and determines perfectly our relations with each being and all beings in nature's varied oneness. It must be at the same time a law and truth that discovers to us at each moment the rhythm and the exact steps of the direct expression of the divine in the soul, mind, life, body of the individual creature. And we find in experience that this supreme light and force of action in its highest expression is at once an imperative law and an absolute freedom. It is an imperative law because it governs by immutable truth our every inner and outer movement. And yet at each moment and in each movement, the absolute freedom of the Supreme handles the perfect plasticity of our conscious and liberated nature.
The ethical idealist tries to discover this supreme law in his own moral data, in the inferior powers and factors that belong to the mental and ethical formula. And to sustain and organize them, he selects a fundamental principle of conduct essentially unsound and constructed by the intellect. Utility, hedonism, reason, intuitive conscience, or any other generalized standard. All such efforts are foredoomed to failure. Our inner nature is the progressive expression of the eternal spirit, and too complex a power to be tied down by a single dominant mental or moral principle. Only this supramental consciousness can reveal to its differing and conflicting forces their spiritual truth and harmonize their divergences.
So I'd like to read the little asterisk. Therefore, the Gita defines Dharma, an expression which means more than either religion or morality, as action controlled by our essential manner of self-being. The later religions endeavor to fix the type of a supreme truth of conduct, erect a system, and declare God's law through the mouth of avatar or prophet. These systems, more powerful and dynamic than the dry ethical idea, are yet for the most part no more than idealistic glorifications of the moral principle sanctified by religious emotion and the label of a superhuman origin. Some, like the extreme Christian ethic, are rejected by nature because they insist unworkably on an impracticable absolute rule. Others prove in the end to be evolutionary compromises and become obsolete in the march of time. The true divine law, unlike these mental counterfeits, cannot be a system of rigid ethical determinations that press into their cast iron molds all our life movements. The law divine is truth of life and truth of the spirit, and must take up with a free living plasticity and inspire with a direct touch of its eternal light each step of our action and all the complexities of our life issues. It must act not as a rule and formula, but as an enveloping and penetrating conscious presence that determines all our thoughts, activities, feelings, impulsions of will by its infallible power and knowledge.
The older religions erected their rule of the wise, their dicta of Manu or Confucius, a complex shastra in which they attempted to combine the social rule and moral law with the declaration of certain eternal principles of our highest nature in some kind of uniting amalgam. All three were treated on the same ground as equally the expression of everlasting verities, Sananta Dharma. But two of these elements are evolutionary and valid for a time. Mental constructions, human readings of the will of the eternal. The third, attached and subdued to certain social and moral formulas, had to share the fortunes of its forms. Either the Shastra grows obsolete and has to be progressively changed or finally cast away, or else it stands as a rigid barrier to the self-development of the individual and the race. The Shastra erects a collective and external standard. It ignores the inner nature of the individual, the indeterminable elements of a secret spiritual force within him. But the nature of the individual will not be ignored. Its demand is inexorable. The unrestrained indulgence of his outer impulses leads to anarchy and dissolution. But the suppression and coercion of his soul's freedom by a fixed and mechanical rule spells stagnation or an inner death. Not this coercion or determination from outside, but the free discovery of his highest spirit and the truth of an eternal movement is the supreme thing that he has to discover.
So I'm beginning to lose track of things because there's a lot of ideas going on in this I don't know if I'm the only one, but I guess maybe finish the section and I don't know what to suggest, or kind of feel like I need to reread parts of it because
Would you like to reread the previous chapter? Would that help?
You mean the previous
chapter? The previous paragraph, I mean.
I kind of would like to reread the whole section.
Yeah, we can next time. We can reread it. No, we can finish. I think we can, because now.
Yeah, we can finish it today. That's good.
The break, and we'll do
finish
it again
today, and the next time we read it over again. Yeah.
Good idea.
Okay.
So who was
it's me next. I also looked up Shastra because I was kind of interested in the word. It says Sanskrit word means precept, rules, manual, compendium, book, or treatise in a general sense.
Would it not be scriptures, holy scriptures also? I read it in this context, perhaps, Shastra. I don't know.
It says the word is generally used as a suffix in Indian literature for technical or specialized knowledge within a defined area of practice.
Okay.
Which would seem to apply here, maybe. The higher ethical... What's going on? The higher ethical law is discovered by the individual in his mind and will and psychic sense, and then extended to the race. The supreme law also must be discovered by the individual in his spirit. Then only through a spiritual influence and not by the mental idea can it be extended to others. A moral law can be imposed as a rule or an ideal on numbers of men who have not attained that level of consciousness or that fineness of mind and will and psychic sense in which it can become a reality to them and a living force. As an ideal, it can be revered without any need of practice. As a rule, it can be observed in its outsides, even if the inner sense is missed altogether. The supramental and spiritual life cannot be recognized in this way. It cannot be turned into a mental idea or an external rule. It has its own great lines, but these must be made real, must be the workings of an active power felt in the individual's consciousness and the transcriptions of an eternal truth powerful to transform mind, life, and body. And because it is thus real, effective, imperative, the generalization of the supramental consciousness and the spiritual life is the sole force that can lead to individual and collective perfection in Earth's highest creatures. Only by our coming into constant touch with the divine consciousness and its absolute truth can some form of the conscious divine, the dynamic absolute, take up our earth existence and transform its strife, stumbling, sufferings, and falsities into an image of the supreme light, power, and Ananda.
The culmination of the soul's constant touch with the supreme is that self-giving, which we call surrender, to the divine will, and emergence of the separated ego in the one who is all. A vast universality of soul and an intense unity with all is the base and fixed condition of the supramental consciousness and spiritual life. In that universality and unity alone can we find the supreme law of the divine manifestation in the life of the embodied spirit. In that alone can we discover the supreme motion and right play of our individual nature. In that alone can all these lower discords resolve themselves into a victorious harmony of the true relations between manifested beings, who are portions of the one Godhead, and children of one universal mother.
Should we finish the chapter? Or should we stop here? We have only 2 pages, I think, 2.5. Or are you tired?
It's just that it's not going through. I mean, I have too many things to think about and I'm not paying attention anymore.
Okay.
yeah, sorry.
Okay, then let's stop here.
Okay. And we are over an hour already, so I think this is good. So we'll start next time back where we started today, right?
Yeah, you could maybe go down one section. I don't think we have to go right back to the beginning, but...
Okay. In the conflict of the claims of society. We'll start there next time.
Today, section 8. There. Yeah. Only 2? And the conflict of the claims of society, okay.
Yeah, that so will be the section.
Paragraph
That's
14.
Good. Then we'll have more time to finish the chapter 2.
Okay.
Jeffrey, would you like to talk about what's going on with you, or would you like to just...
Well, I mean, to some extent, it's... I mean, I have also issues with the Absolute, but I mean, he discusses the Absolute in kind of interesting terms, which I'm, you know, I'm enjoying, because he sort of says, well, there's the Absolute, which is the way humans deal with the Absolute, which isn't going to work. And then there's another kind of Absolute, which is what he's also talking about. So I'm kind of interested in that difference, but then I get hung up on the terms as we go forward. Mm-hmm. You know, and then
what is
I
the
find
other
my
absolute? What is the other absolute you distinguish?
Well, the divine absolute, which I still have troubles with, but you know, he's making a distinction between...
Okay.
The absolute in the terms of like a dogma or a morality that is applied in a kind as a kind of absolute reference, which is clearly a problem, and we all know that from you know, history and real life, if you like. And he makes a distinction between that kind of absolute and the divine absolute, right? But I still have troubles with the divine absolute as well, so. So then I start getting having to maintain 2 states of mind as I'm reading it, where I'm holding the stuff that I disagree with as I'm reading the rest of it and saying, okay, we won't challenge that right now, we'll keep reading it. And the more complex his argument gets, the harder it does it is for me to maintain these different states, you know. So
yeah, makes total sense.
And then he does this which I also find this really interesting about the idea that ultimately the morality isn't a set of laws, it's a state of mind or a state of being, let's say, and that comes from attaining a certain degree of awareness of the divine. And you don't need the laws at that point. You just need the state, you know, which I also find very interesting, because a lot of the religions codify the morality into a set of laws and dogmas. And he's arguing against that in a way. He kind of says it's maybe a necessary intermediate step, but ultimately it's not what we're trying for.
Right.
Which I also find a very interesting argument. So then he comes back to where I am with, you know, so now I've got this sort of section off to one side. Now we come back to this idea of which I agree with. And then I'm a bit confused and I'm no longer holding all the pieces in my mind, partly by fatigue and other things as well. So
overload.
Yeah, overload. Plus the, you know, the higher lower thing that we discussed earlier, which is, yeah, so.
Yeah, thank you, Jeffrey. That's well said.
It was a bit chaotic in the way of saying it, but
well, it sounds like that's what you were expressing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I liked especially the last thing that you, but I had already forgot it.
What about the fact that they don't? He's not advocating for moral laws. He's advocating for a state of being, which goes beyond the need to write down these things as moral laws, right? So,
yes, but
and also this argument and that sorry, I'm jumping. This argument in there that many of the religions rely on a prophet or a person to incarnate these things, and he's saying that also is an imperfection that's not going to ultimately. Has its own flaws built into it, you know, which is also a really interesting argument. You know,
exactly. So. But I think this is the point of all the chapter in a certain sense, extended not only to the moral laws, but to every state of the individual and of the collective social development. And every stage of our evolution has its reason to be, has it good, has its light and dark side, so to speak. And it's here we are again at the point of previous, we can recast it in the sense that it is neither good nor bad, but it has its purpose, but it is transitional. It's something transitional. Towards what? He contends that divine supramental state of being. And everything that we are in between is not necessarily true or false, but it's, well, in his words, it's probably in a sort of mixture. Yeah? It is a mixture between light and darkness, truth and falsehood. And only in the, yeah, only the absolute has this absolute divinity and perfection, everything in between. And what I like in any case, that he never says this is absolutely good or absolutely bad. He criticizes also religions and all the various stages of our social development and individual state. But he says, don't forget that even if you feel very comfortable in that kind of system, institution, or religion, or whatever, remember that it is only a transitionary state. Sooner or later, it will have to change and go towards something else.
So the word that he comes back to again and again when describing the supramental or the absolute is plasticity.
Yeah.
So it seems a contradiction to the word absolute.
Yeah.
Absolute sounds really rigid. But the main or one of the main aspects of what he calls the absolute or the divine consciousness is utter plasticity. There's nothing rigid. Everything can, it flows. It flows in the moment. So it's completely unrigid, which is contradictory to how the word sounds. The word of the absolute sounds really like,
yeah.
I am, you know?
Good point.
But I don't tend to believe in one truth. I mean, this is the same with capital T truth. I don't believe in capital T truth, no matter how many times Aurobindo uses the term. Andrea, you said to me, think about it as right, capital R, right, rather than capital T truth. I can get my head around capital R, right, easier, more easily than I can get my head around capital T truth. Because right is something that we can that we can know ourselves in our own self. Truth is completely abstract. I mean, how does anybody know what a truth is, except in a purely functional sign kind of fact kind of level? But in terms of other things, it's a complete abstraction for me. Whereas right is not an abstraction. Right is something for which with which I have a sense of what is right and what is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
My sense of what is right and what is wrong doesn't always match up with anybody's moral dictates. You know, some of my sense of what is right matches up with Christian right, but other things that I think are right matches up with what Christians call wrong. Same for Buddhism, same, you know, for all of the religions, my mapping of rightness doesn't match up with any of the moral dictates. But I know for myself what I consider to be right and wrong.
I think that's actually
what I do not know what is considered truth. I am, and I think that my truth can be very different from your truth. So, you know, I have no sense of absolute truth in any difficulty with the idea of absolute truth, but I'm not sure what absolute right is either, but I know what right is for me. That's the only thing I can.
But perhaps the absolute truth contains also all the falsehoods. No? If you see it from this perspective, the absolute
truth. But absolute truth suggests there's a single. See,
no.
On all my emails now going out, I have the sign underneath, the first right of a human being is to be inconsistent. I do not believe in a consistent universe.
Yeah. What do you mean by consistent universe?
A universe that is free of logical or causal flaws, what we would call logical or causal.
Yeah.
I do not think the universe is bound to be logically consistent or even causally consistent. I think time works differently than we think it does.
Yeah, exactly.
So
it is not the logic is a mental logic, a human logic.
Exactly.
And the divine logic is exactly something that is not a human logic. And that's precisely for that reason that I say that the absolute truth contains also all the falsehoods.
But
it is illogical from the rational point of view.
There is one truth. I don't believe in it.
No, but I don't read Schreuben in that way.
I think it's a language. I think it's a language thing. I come back to the plasticity.
Yeah.
That if it applies to the absolute, it applies to truth. It's we do not know that. We can only sense into it and open to it. It's like whatever we come up with will always be limited. And the divine is not. And I think that is where you like the unlimited mind and concepts, I believe. I think I hear you defending what Schreuber is actually describing.
In fact, Schreuber isn't. I don't think that Schreuber is saying that there is only one truth. As I interpret it, is that he says that divine contains all the contraries and is able to reconcile what for the mind is not reconcilable.
But reconciling assumes that it sounds like you're trying to push it into one place.
No, you have, it is again the plasticity.
You're trying to get consistency. That's what reconciling means.
It's like a diamond with a lot of facets, and every facet is a truth in a certain sense, with question mark. No, it is in a certain sense is a truth, but these facets can be also contraries, polarities. And if you look at the mental level, you see it must be or that or that. And from the divine standpoint of view, you can see that it can be both. One, two, or three. That's how I reach Aurobindo, in the sense that it is a everything is contained in the divine. Therefore, in a certain sense, there is no truth and no falsehood. Because if you speak of an absolute truth, it means also that there can be nothing else than it. So from the logical point of view, there can be nothing wrong either. Everything what manifests has its truth. And only from the supramental point of view, you see how it makes sense and has its value, its meaning.
I'm willing to be coaxed into a different way of thinking. But...
yeah, okay. I was trying just to see if it's possible to cast it into words. Yeah. Yeah.
What helps me with this issue, Jeffrey, is an image, like a dome. And so you have, let's just say a teepee or something like that, but in a dome shape. So you have supports coming up on this side and on this side, on this side. From this point of view, not from this point of view, from this point of view, a mental point of view, there's this and there's that, and they're not the same. There's no one truth. There's this truth and this truth and this other truth and this other truth. And as you get up to the top, they all come together. All of these beams or supports come together into this single point. And the single point it's single, but it's not a contradiction. It doesn't contradict multiplicity. Mm-hmm. It's both. Mm-hmm. And Sri Aurobindo's, it doesn't work very well for the mind, because the mind works with definitions, with opposites. That's how we say, okay, this is rain, this is not snow. I know this is rain, it's not snow. And so we use separations, distinctions, definition. Definition means to make an end of something. So you set boundaries around it. That's how the mind works. And he's talking about something that's beyond the mind. That's what supramental means. It's, somebody said, it's just a technical term that means beyond the mind. But until you experience it, you know, it's like, what is that, beyond the mind? Because we're mental beings. And probably occasionally some of us have the experience of not being stuck in dualities. But that doesn't deny the multiplicity of things.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, for the mind, the expression multiplicity in unity is a self-contradiction. Or it is one, or it is two, or many, but it is still one. And it's the one expresses itself in many. So is it many, or it is one? The mind, it's something for the mind that is not, but intuitively I can feel it. I think that one can speak with metaphors. There's this famous metaphor of the Vedas, no, where they said this Brahman. Brahman is, all is Brahman at the end of the story. It's nothing else exists than the one Brahman, nothing. And to make it clear, they say it is like the sun that shines on the ripples of the ocean, and you see a lot of images of the sun, and you think that these are many suns, and in reality, it is only one sun that shines through on the ocean ripples of water and reflects itself as many, and yet it is one. So these are things that, of course, only metaphorical, but because the mind does not get there, but intuitively, I feel it to be very, very true. There's a deeper truth, I think, for me.
I don't have any issues with that. That's not where my issues are, I don't think. Multiplicity in the one, and
The same I apply with the truth and falsehood.
It's the T truth, as if it was a single entity laid out like that. It has to do with maybe the way the language is used. But the problem is language creates expectations and images and people. And so if the language is wrong in some sense, it will create the wrong effect. I mean, I'm not saying that, you know, I think Aurobindo was probably aware of the traps of language in what he was doing. So I'm not saying that he was unaware of it, but I do think that there are, you know, and he was writing in a certain time. And this is part of why I struggle with Aurobindo and his writings, because I think that he was writing in the way he was doing, because he was writing in the sort of earlier 20th century. And the way that we as scientists understood the world and the sort of general sense about how the world and the language of the time. And these things have changed. Our scientific understanding of the world has changed since then. And Aurobindo, and they were the first to say, our point of view has to be compatible with the scientific perspective. He wasn't saying that this stands separate from science, but we also have to update his understanding and the way that he expresses in his text for what we now know based on scientific science. And so this is our argument about the higher and the evolutionist thing, which I have difficulty with, because I don't think that's the modern understanding of science. I think increasingly we do not view evolution as a forward motion towards intelligence. We now think of evolution as a development towards multiple ways of understanding and interacting with the world, of which human is one, but not the best, not necessarily the best. So we have to rethink Aurobindo as a result of that. I mean, you know, the arguments to some extent. It's a complicated thing.
Yeah, I understand. But that's precisely because why I like Sri Aurobindo, because I think Sri Aurobindo was light years ahead of science, and science sooner or later will reach that point that Sri Aurobindo is talking about. Also with the evolutionary theories. I'm writing a book on that. When I will have finished, I will tell you.
Oh, my dear ones, I'm really ready to bow out, even though it's a great conversation. So if you want to go on, then I'm going to step
out.
No,
I'm finished. I'm good. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, fine.
Thank you all. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Do you want to do a meditation to finish up with?
Yep.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you all. Thank you.
Bye-bye. See you next time.
Next bye. Weeks. Bye-bye.